Stand by for the Terry Saul Show. 5, roll tape. 4, cue Terry. 3, bring audio up. 2, stand by. 1, play intro.
Stay tuned for the Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM and 1220 AM, KSLM. Today's show is being brought to you by the Willamette Queen Sternwheeler. The next time you plan an event, think of the Queen. And by the Lule Group, featuring Lule's Car Connection, Don Lule Homes, and Teresa Lule's State Farm Insurance.
Well, good morning and welcome to the Terry Saul Show here on 104.3 FM, 1220 AM, KSLM. I am your host, Terry Saul, and today our special guest is me. Terry Saul, I've wanted to do this show for quite some time. I wanted to talk a little bit about something that was on my bucket list for many, many years. It all goes back to November 22nd, 1962. Okay. I was in the second grade back then. I was in Mrs. Schulte's class at Bookson Elementary School in San Jose, California. It was during the late morning recess, and we were all out there, and we were just kind of hanging out and doing what, you know, normal seven-year-old kids do on a beautiful morning. And somebody came up to me and said, "The president has been shot." And I thought, huh. Interesting. Well, the bell rang at the end of that recess, and we all went back to our classrooms, and we're sitting in our classroom, and we noticed that Mrs. Schulte, our teacher, wasn't there yet. And we were all just kind of sitting there wondering, well, what's going on here? A couple seconds goes by, Mrs. Schulte comes walking in, and she's visibly upset, and she says, "We all need to go down to the cafeteria because we're having a school-wide special assembly." So we gathered up our stuff and we went down to the cafeteria, and a couple of minutes goes by and in comes Mrs. Norton. Now, Mrs. Norton was our principal, and I'm telling you, Mrs. Norton intimidated the hell out of all of us. She knew everybody's name in that entire school. She never smiled, and when you would walk by her, you would say, "Good morning, Mrs. Norton," and she'd look at me and say, "Good morning, Terry," and it was just kind of intimidating. Well, all of a sudden, Mrs. Norton comes walking into the cafeteria full of students, and she's crying. I remember looking at her. I was beginning to get concerned and upset. Mrs. Norton was crying? I'd never seen an adult cry before, especially Mrs. Norton. And she says, "We just got word that the president, John F. Kennedy, has been shot and killed in downtown Dallas, Texas." And I remember just kind of sitting there in disbelief. And she says, "At this point, everybody is going home. School has been canceled. It's been dismissed the rest of the day. Go home." So we packed up our things and I walked home. School was only maybe a half a mile away, and I would walk to school each day and walk home each day. It was back then in 1962, 63, 64. You could do that and you could feel safe. So I remember walking home thinking, this is kind of bizarre. Got home and I immediately called my mom at her work, which I did each and every day when I got home, and tell her I was home from school and everything was okay. And I says, "Mom, I'm home." She says, "What are you home so early for? Do you feel okay?" And I go, "Yeah, I'm fine." I says, "But the president was shot and killed." And she says, "Who told you that?" And I said, "Mrs. Norton did." My mom worked at my dad's television shop. It was called House of Video, over on Stevens Creek Boulevard in San Jose. She had a whole showroom full of televisions. So she turned one on and she watched it, and she says, "I'm coming home, son." I said, "Okay." And she came home. And when she got home, we turned on our big RCA 25-inch color television. We were the only ones on the block back then that had a color television, and that was because my dad owned a television shop. And she turned on the TV, and we sat there, and we watched the television. We were glued to the set for that entire weekend. And I remember thinking, after watching the news coverage, one day, I'm going to go to Dallas, and I'm going to go there, and I'm going to see everything that happened. That's how I began my bucket list. So let's move up several years. It is now 2020. The opportunity comes up where I'm going to be doing a run through Texas. And I thought to myself, okay, great. Well, I was planning to do a special event in San Antonio. We had a couple of days after that event, before the next event, which was going to be in Dallas. And I said to myself, this is it. It's taken me 57 years, but I'm going to be able to check off this check on my bucket list. What was on that bucket list? I wanted to go to Dallas. I wanted to go to the Texas Schoolbook Depository Building. I wanted to go to the Grassy Knoll. I wanted to go to the Texas Theater where Lee Oswald was captured. I wanted to go to the intersection of 10th and Patton where Officer J.D. Tippett was allegedly gunned down by Lee Oswald. I wanted to go to Fort Worth to see Lee Oswald's grave. I wanted to see it all. So my wife, Patty, and I got on a plane. It was 68 degrees in Portland, Oregon, and it was cloudy, and we had to fly to Las Vegas in order to get a connecting flight into Texas. So we took the flight, and anybody that listens to my radio show over the years knows that I'm not a big fan of flying. Never have, probably never will. Even though back in the day, back in the early 80s, I jumped out of airplanes. That's right. I actually did some skydiving. I wasn't a daddy. I wasn't married. And I probably didn't have all my faculties upstairs. But I did that. I had several jumps out of an airplane. I enjoyed it until the very last jump when I tried to land standing up because, hey, everybody was doing that. And I remember landing, standing up, and crashing to the ground. And my jump master came over and says, "You okay?" I go, "Oh, yeah, I'm fine." He goes, "Well, get up." And I go, "Well, I wish I could. My ankle is hurting." And that was my last skydiving attempt. No more. Back to Texas. We flew into Las Vegas to change planes. Had some time in Vegas. We love going to Vegas. I performed in Vegas many times. We got off the plane, and it was 104 degrees in Las Vegas. And it's like, are you kidding? I mean, we were dressed Portland, 68 degrees. Not Las Vegas, 104 degrees. Well, it was. And it was warm. No, it wasn't. It was downright hot. So we had a few hours in Vegas before we got on the plane. We ended up getting on the plane and flying to San Antonio. Never been to San Antonio. Beautiful, beautiful city. Got off the plane. It was still 104 degrees. Come on, people. It was just balmy. It was hot. It was balmy. It was 104 degrees. We ended up getting a rental car. We went to our hotel, which was actually a condo, and it had an upstairs and a downstairs. Now, we had asked our friends, Captain Richard and Barbara Chesbrough from the Willamette Queen, to go with us. And I said, I remember saying to both of them one night at dinner, I go, "Hey, we're going to Texas. It's going to be hot. We're going to be down there for a week. You guys want to go?" And they both looked at each other like, "Why would we want to go?" And I go, "Come on." And they says, "Sure, okay. I don't understand it, but okay." That's what good friends do, I guess. Barbara was in charge of getting the hotel. We took care of the transportation, and Barbara's going to get us the hotel. She got us a really nice condo. Upstairs, downstairs, it was just incredibly nice. And we got it there, had a full kitchen, a living room. I mean, it was just a beautiful place. But it was still hot. It was still hot. And I remember we got into our room, got all settled and everything, and walked out on the balcony there. And it was about 8:30 at night, and it was still 104 degrees. Is that the only number those people knew down there was 104? Well, it was. And so we had an enjoyable evening there. The next day, we had plenty of time. So he says, "Let's go drive through San Antonio. Let's go take a look at San Antonio. Let's go see it all." San Antonio is a beautiful city. We drove around. One of the things that I wanted to go see was the Alamo. You go to San Antonio, you must see the Alamo. And I remember we were driving around and we saw a sign that says the Alamo next right. So we pulled into this parking lot about a block away from the Alamo, got out of the car, still 100 and I think it was about 106 degrees at that point. But you know, once it gets that high, you don't even notice. You don't even know the difference. 104, 106, it's still hotter than hell. You don't know the difference. So we get out of the vehicle. Now, when we travel, usually Patty or I will always go get some cash. You know, you always have to have a little bit of cash, even though everything's now done by card these days, but we need a little bit of cash. And I remember looking at Patty and I says, "Did you go get some cash before we left Portland?" She looked at me and says, "No, didn't you?" "No." So now I look at Barbara and Richard and I said, "We got to find an ATM because I don't have any cash." And they both looked at us like, "You people are knuckleheads. You travel and you don't carry cash?" No, we didn't. We are starting to look around. Do you know there's not an ATM anywhere in San Antonio? We looked and looked and looked and looked. Couldn't find an ATM. Couldn't find any banks anywhere. I mean, up here in Salem, Oregon, we have banks on every corner. San Antonio, they don't. So we were walking to the Alamo from the parking lot. and I saw this really fancy hotel. So I stuck my head in the ground. Hey, where's an ATM around here? And the guy goes, well, we've got one downstairs. Great. Shot down the stairs. Beautiful hotel, by the way. Found the ATM, withdrew some cash. And so I walked back up there and I was strutting pretty good. I go, found it. And Barbara looks at me and says, what'd you find? I found the ATM, got some cash. We're good. And they all thought, this guy's not strange. He just downright lost it. So we continue on walking through the downtown area. And all of a sudden we come around this one block and we walk down and there it is. We're standing in front of the Alamo. And I remember looking at this and I'm thinking how small the Alamo is. And it's right in the middle of a street. I mean, there's buildings on one side, there's buildings on the other side, and the Alamo's right there. And you stand there and you're looking at it. And I'm thinking, why did it take Davy Crockett and Jim Bowie and those folks so many days to defend this thing? It's so small, give it to them. We decide to get our picture taken in front of the Alamo. So the four of us stood there and we took our pictures. And then we decided, well, let's go inside because you can go inside. Well, there's a park ranger right at the door there. And they tell you, when you go inside, please don't touch anything. We're trying to preserve the Alamo. So just don't touch anything. You're free to go in there. You're free to look around. But this is the original Alamo. We've done very, very little to upgrade it or anything. So please just don't touch things. So we walked in the door to get out of that 106-degree temperature, and I noticed the temperature was 72 degrees inside, and I thought, wow, how do they keep it so cool? It's because they have air conditioning, dummy. And I thought, wait a minute, you guys just told us that it was because of the stones or something that it was kept cool? No, they had air conditioning there. Okay, so they preserved it, but they also added air conditioning. So we walked around inside the Alamo for quite a while there and looked at it, and they have videos going of everything. And then you walk through the Alamo, the main church part there, and you can go out into the courtyard, and there's another small building. So we walked into the small building, which happened to be a gift shop. Yeah, you got to have the gift shop, and sells all the souvenirs and stuff. Well, we're pin collectors. When we go someplace, we always try to get a pin, and we have this wall hanging that Patty made, and we stick the pins in the wall hanging there. And so I thought, well, we got to pick us up a pin. So we looked around and finally we found a pin and we walked around a little bit and we thought, okay, this is the Alamo. And then the girls decided, well, let's go over to the mall there and do some shopping. Of course, when you go to a mall, you got to go do some shopping. So we walked across the street to the mall there, a beautiful, beautiful mall. San Antonio is just a gorgeous city. And walked around a little bit, and the girls did some shopping and stuff there. Walked by a Dallas Cowboys store, and of course, we're wearing our Denver Broncos stuff, and started to walk in, and the guy looked at us like, what are you guys doing here? So we had a good time in the mall. Then we left, decided, okay, this was fun. Let's go drive around San Antonio some more and check in some more of the sites. So that's what we did. When we come back, I'm going to tell you where we ended up. And by the way, yes, we did get to Dallas on this journey. More of my bucket list checkoff when we come back.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM. Brought to you today by the Lule Group and the Willamette Queen Sternwheeler. You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM. Brought to you today by the Lule Group and the Willamette Queen Sternwheeler.
Welcome back to The Terry Saul Show. We are talking about my bucket checkoff, our checklist. I've always had a trip to Texas on my bucket list. Well, since 1963, when President Kennedy was assassinated, I've always wanted to go to Texas, to Dallas, and see him. So when we just last left off, we were in San Antonio, just got through seeing the Alamo, and it was kind of neat to see, but, you know, okay, we saw it. Would I ever go back to see the Alamo again? Probably not. No, been there, done that. So now we're in the car, and we're starting to drive back to our hotel, and I see a sign that says LBJ Ranch, 10 miles. So I said, hey, it's still early in the day. Let's go check this out. Let's go see the LBJ Ranch. I had forgotten that President Lyndon Baines Johnson was also from Texas and lived there. So we drove out to the LBJ Ranch. It's in Johnson City, Texas. You cross this little bridge and then you're on the property. Huge, huge property. And of course, it's run by the state of Texas. And there was this little, not really a gift shop. I guess it was a gift shop, but it was also the information center. And we walked in there, and there was one lady behind the counter there, and nobody else in the shop. And so we're kind of sitting there looking around, and Patty and Barbara and Richard are all looking around at the different things that they had in the gift shop. And I walked up to the lady, and I says, "Ma'am, can I ask you a question?" I says, "Why is there nobody here?" And she just kind of looked at me and she smiled and she says, "What do you mean?" I go, "Well, there's nobody here. We're the only ones in this little gift shop here. There's no cars in the parking lot. The property almost looks like it's vacant. Why is there nobody here?" And she says, "The real reason, he wasn't liked." And I go, "What are you talking about?" She says, "President Johnson wasn't very well liked. He was not a popular president. He wasn't very well liked. So we don't get a lot of visitors come to the property here." And I go, "Seriously? But he was a president." She says, "Doesn't matter." She says, "He was a mean man." And she says, "He was a overpowering man. He was a big fella." And I says, "Well, what do you mean he was mean?" And she just says, "He was a mean man." As we're leaving, I'm thinking, well, this was kind of weird. And then there's another gentleman, an elderly gentleman that's walking in there with appeared to be his wife, and it looked like a grandchild. And I says, "Oh, you here to go see the mean man too?" And he looked at me and smiled and he says, "What are you talking about?" And I go, "Well, the lady inside there just told me that President Johnson was a mean man," and he started laughing. And I go, "You find that funny?" He says, "I knew him." And I go, "Oh, you did?" He goes, "Yes, I was on the Secret Service detail that was protecting him." And I said, "Okay, then let me ask you this question. Was he mean?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah." He says, "He didn't even know our names. His security detail, the people that would throw their life down on for him, he didn't even know our names. He used to refer to them as Secret Service, Secret Service. Grab my suitcase over there, Secret Service." And I go, "How long were you on his detail?" He says, "About a year and a half until I got fired." And I says, "Why did you get fired?" He says, "Because one day he yelled at me, 'Secret Service, I left my briefcase over there. Go get it.'" And he turned around and looked at him. He said, "Sir, if your briefcase has a bomb in it or somebody's shooting it, I will protect it. Otherwise, go get it yourself." And apparently President Johnson did not like that and had him removed from his detail the next day. So we are looking around, and they give you a map. And the map has the little cemetery where the president is laid to rest. They have his house, his childhood house. They have an actual airstrip that was made on the property there, and they have the airplane. Now, the airplane is not a full-size Boeing plane like we see the president's drive. It's a real small aircraft, and the reason it's there, and it's painted in the colors, the presidential colors, the white and the blue, and it says United States of America. It's got the flag on the side there. When we got over there, they had a gentleman right there, and I was asking him about this, and I says, why is this here? He said, "President Johnson used to fly this from Washington right here and land right here on this airstrip. That way he didn't have to land in San Antonio and drive out here to this. He was right here." And the plane is open and you can go inside there. And I remember walking inside there and looking around and I thought, man, this is tiny. This is cramped. And it held 12 people. And you could look in the cockpit and you could look around. And I thought, this must have been an uncomfortable ride. And so when I walked back out, I said to the gentleman there, I says, wow. And he goes, yeah, not a lot of people liked going on this aircraft. He says, it bounced you around, but the president wanted it. And I says, how many acres is this property? And the gentleman looked at me and says, it's 2,400 acres. And I said, 2,400? My word. He says, but you got to understand, he acquired a lot of it after he became president. And I says, why is that? He said, he would walk up to somebody, a neighbor, and say, hey, I hear your property is up for sale. And the neighbor would look at him and say, no, it's not. And the president would look back and say, yes, it is. And he would give him pennies on the dollar for the property. And that's how he acquired so much property, 2,400 acres of some beautiful land in Johnson City, Texas. So we kind of looked around and they have a little museum there. We looked through that and you could see, but again, there was like one or two people there. It just wasn't very well attended. And as we got back in the car, we were driving through the property there and they had this little fenced in area that was a cemetery. So of course we got out and walked up there, and the two largest stones there were the one of President Johnson and Lady Bird Johnson. And there was about 15 or 20 other stones, and they were also members of the Johnson family, sister, brother, cousin, daughter, whoever. I noticed that the president's stones were huge. Him and his wife had the two biggest stones there. The rest of them were all just kind of like small compared to him. So we got in the car and we drove around a little bit more of the property. And I thought, this is some beautiful, beautiful property. And then you got to wonder, boy, if the stories on this property could talk, what would they say? What would they be? And I thought, wow. So as we left, I mean, it was quite the drive on the property and quite the drive to get off the property. We left. We says, okay, so tomorrow we're heading to Dallas. We're going to drive up to Dallas. We have to go through Waco, Texas. We have to go through Austin, Texas. Austin, Texas is beautiful, by the way. And we have to go through Waco, Texas. And I'm thinking, Waco, Texas, isn't that where the Camp Davidian massacre and all that other stuff happened? We are not able to stop there at all because there was a traffic jam all the way up. And I mean, it was stop and go, stop and go, stop and go. But finally, we're getting closer and closer to Dallas. We're going to take a break right now. But when we come back, we actually arrived in Dallas, and I'll be telling you more about that. You're listening to The Terry Saul Show right here on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM, 1220 AM. I'm Terry Saul, and we're heading into Dallas.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM, brought to you today by the Lule Group and the Willamette Queen Sternwheeler. You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM, brought to you today by the Lule Group and the Willamette Queen Sternwheeler.
Welcome back to The Terry Saul Show. On our last segment, we were talking about the fact that we had just gone through Johnson City, Texas. We were on our way, went through Austin, Texas, beautiful skyline in Austin, Texas. I mean, it was just gorgeous up there. Went through Waco, Texas, a lot of traffic going through Waco, Texas. There was a good traffic jam there. And we're making our way to Dallas, Texas. This is where I wanted to go. For over 57 years, I wanted to go to Dallas, Texas. I wanted to go see the Texas School Book Depository building. I wanted to see it all. So we arrive in Dallas. Dallas is one of the prettiest cities I have ever seen. We're driving around, and we're looking for our hotel. Barbara Chesbrough, Richard Chesbrough were with us, our good friends. And Barbara set up our hotels. She set us up at the Omni Hotel in downtown Texas. It is a 5-star hotel. It is just beautiful. So we get there, and as we're checking in, they said, where do you want to, which floor you want on? I go, well, send me, I like being up high. So they put us on the 17th floor. When we were checking in, I asked the clerk there, I said, so how far away is the Texas School Book Depository building? He says, 2 blocks. You're 2 blocks away. I go, you're kidding. We're that close? He goes, oh yeah, 2 blocks away. I looked at Patty, and I looked at Richard and Barbara, and I go, let's get everything settled and go for a walk. And the guy looked at me and he says, probably wouldn't suggest doing that. And I go, why is that? He goes, well, it's starting to get dark. The building's probably not in the best section of town, so I wouldn't take a walk over there. I'd wait and go over tomorrow. And I'm thinking, yeah, okay. We get up to our room. Beautiful room. Oh my goodness. The view from the 17th floor over Texas was just fabulous. Just a beautiful, beautiful room. Barbara did great on booking this room. So we went down, we had some dinner. Patty's looking at me and she goes, you want to go for a walk, don't you? And I go, yeah, I kind of do. Richard and Barbara are looking at us and they're going, well, we're not letting you guys walk over there by yourself because the guy told us it's not the best neighborhood, blah, blah, blah. So we go, come on, it's 2 blocks away. Let's go for the walk. So we start to take the walk and we walk 2 blocks and it's hot. Keep in mind, this is still hot. It's still over 100 degrees. I haven't gotten used to this heat yet. And we're taking the walk and we're heading over to the Texas School Book Depository building. We walk 1 block over and 2 blocks down and all of a sudden, there it is, right there on the corner. Just like I've seen it in pictures for 100 times. There it is, the Texas School Book Depository building. And I look up to the 6th floor and there's the window. The window that Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly was looking out. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness. I'm finally, after 57 years, I'm standing in front of this building. Well, there's a guy across the street, and he walks up to us and says, tourists? And I go, yeah. And he starts telling us the stories. He's telling us about everything that happened that particular day in Dallas in 1963. And he's talking about everything. And he's giving us his story. And he's going on and on and on. And about 10 minutes later, he finally says, you know, I'm out here every day, and I talk to people every day, especially these tourists like yourselves, but I don't do it for free. And he says, I usually try to be compensated for it. And I thought, oh boy, here it comes. So he's kind of holding out his hand, and he says, I usually like to get $10 a person. And I thought, well, I'm not giving you $20 for what you just did, and Barbara and Richard aren't going to give you $20. So I reached in my pocket. All I had was a $5 bill, and I gave him the $5. Richard and Barbara gave him something, and he turned around and he walked away. I think he was a little bit irritated with this, but it didn't matter. So we're sitting there, and we're looking at the building. I'm looking over at the grassy knoll, and we realize, okay, we need to really head back to the hotel because it was really getting dark. Actually, it was dark, and we needed to walk back. So as we're walking back, we notice that the four of us all of a sudden are kind of crunched together because, again, it's not in the best part of town. It's dark. You're walking back. And there were a lot of, oh, let's just say folks in the street kind of watching us as we walked by. I noticed that we kind of picked up our pace a little bit as we got closer and closer to the hotel. So we finally got in this beautiful hotel, and I thought, I saw it. Tomorrow, I'm going there, and tomorrow I'm going to touch that building. Next morning, we get up, we have our breakfast, and we said, okay, let's go. Well, we decided that we are going to drive, even though it was only 2 blocks away. We're going to drive because we wanted to park the car there because we had intentions of going on. We wanted to go on to see the Texas Theater where Oswald was captured. We wanted to go to 10th and Patton where Officer J.D. Tippit was assassinated. We wanted to go to Dallas-Fort Worth to see the grave that Oswald is in. So we drove the car over, and you can actually park right behind the Texas School Book Depository building. So we get out, and the first thing I did was I walked over to the building, and I'm touching the wall. I just needed to touch that building. And I'm looking there, and I'm going, wow, wow, if history could only say something to me right now. And so I asked somebody there, I go, so how do you get up to the 6th floor? Because there's a museum up there. You can actually go up to the 6th floor. He says, well, you have to go across the street to that little gift shop over there and purchase your ticket. And I says, okay. Well, there was also another museum a block away that Richard and Barbara wanted to go see. So we decided to split up. They were going to go to their museum, and Patty and I were going to go up to the Texas School Book Depository building. But first, we had to get our tickets. So we walked across the street to this little gift shop, and they had all kinds of memorabilia there. And so there was one photograph that I thought, and we've all seen it. It was the photograph that was taken just as Jack Ruby was lunging forward and shooting Lee Oswald. And I looked at the photograph and it was crystal clear. And I said to the guy, I go, how much is that? And he goes, $750. And I go, you know what? I'll take it. I'd like one. And he goes, okay, they're in the back room. And I thought, back room? That's kind of weird. All right. So he goes in the back room and comes back a couple seconds later, and he's holding on to it. And I'm looking around, and I'm looking for a pin. You know, we collect pins, like I told you earlier. And I found a pin. And so the pin was like, I don't know, $4, $5. And Patty picked up a little knickknack here or there. And we go to check out, and he goes, okay, it is $765 and some odd cents. And I looked at him and said, excuse me? And he says, $765 and some odd change. And I go, you're kidding, right? And he says, no, why? And I go, how much was that photograph? He goes, $750. And I says, you told me $750. He goes, yeah, $750, $750. For that photograph? He says, it's one of the originals. I said, take it back. I don't want it. Not for that kind of a price, because I can get that photograph off a line or anywhere else, but I'm not paying that. So that was shock number one. And so we get it back. We purchase our tickets. It was $18 a ticket. And you go back across, and you have certain times that you're allowed to go up there. Ours was for 1:30. So we had about an hour to kill before we could go up there. So we decided to walk. And we're walking around the building. As I'm walking down towards the grassy knoll, I was surprised. The grassy knoll is located right next to the building. When we see it on TV, when you see it in photographs, it looks like it's a block or two away. It's not. It's right next to the building. And I was surprised just how close it was. We walked down to the grassy knoll area there. As I was walking down, I noticed there is a large X in the middle of the street. And about 50 feet down further, there is another large X. And somebody was standing on the X taking a selfie. And I thought, oh, that's kind of awkward. So I asked the guy, I go, what does the X mean? He goes, this first X is where Kennedy was first hit by the first bullet. The second X is where the fatal bullet hit the president. And you're standing on these X's taking a selfie? Kind of morbid. And so I thought, all right. So I'm walking over to the grassy knoll, and I start to walk up the grassy knoll there, and there's a gentleman standing there with a display, a table display, a little TV, and a video rolling, and all kinds of photographs. And I go, what are you doing here? And he goes, oh, you came up to see where the second shooter was. And I looked at him, I said, second shooter? And he goes, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. So I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at his stuff, and he goes, come here. And I walk over, and he goes, stand behind this fence right here. And I'm standing behind the fence, and it's behind a tree. And he says, this is where the second shooter was. Look at your shot. Look at your angle. Look at your view. And I thought, oh, my gosh, he's got a clear shot. He's got a perfectly clear shot of the motorcade. And I says, well, how do you know there was a second shooter? He says, look at this. And he showed me a video and some photographs of a man wearing a blue suit walking away carrying what looked like a rifle. And I says, has the government seen this? Do they know? He goes, oh, yeah. He says, they're well aware of it. It came out about 13 years ago. They haven't commented on it. They don't want to say nothing about it. And I go, really? And I go, so it's your theory that there was a second shooter? He goes, oh, yeah. And this, you're standing in the spot where the second shooter was. And I'll tell you right now, it was kind of an eerie feeling. I go, really? We walked back out. It was getting close to go up to the museum. And we walk in there. And we go into the ground floor there, air conditioned, by the way, thank you very much. And they give you these headphones and like a little transistor radio. And they says, when you get up on the sixth floor, there's several displays on that floor. Each display is numbered. Punch in the number on your little radio there, the little device, and listen with your headphones, and it'll tell you what the display is, what you're looking at. I said, okay. So we get in the elevator, Patty and I do, and there's about maybe 15 or 20 high school kids that were on vacation, and they were pretty loud and rowdy and, you know, just laughing and joking and talking about anything and everything. And all of a sudden, the doors open on the sixth floor, and nobody said a word. It got very quiet. All of those high school kids just shut up. They stopped talking. It got real quiet, and as you walk out, you realize where you're at. I'm on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository building, the same floor that Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly shot the President of the United States. And they have different displays up there. And you walk around and you look around and you look around and you see all these different displays there. And then you come up to the window. My gosh, this is the window. And you can look out the window. And they have the boxes there that were still there. And they actually have the rifle that was used in a case. And you can see the rifle. And I'm looking at the rifle and I'm looking out the window and I'm thinking, wait a minute, wait 1 minute. This just doesn't look right at all. And I looked at Patty and I says, Patty, something's not right here. And she says, what do you mean? I go, I don't know. But I just can't figure it out. When we come back, I'll talk about it.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM. Brought to you today by the Lule Group and the Willamette Queen Sternwheeler. You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM. Brought to you today by the Lule Group and the Willamette Queen Sternwheeler.
Welcome back to our final segment here. We're talking today about my trip to Texas. I wanted to go to Dallas, Texas to see the area where the president was assassinated back in 1963. We're now up on the sixth floor building of the Texas School Book Depository building. We're looking out the window that Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly fired the shots. And I thought, he's got this bolt action rifle. A bolt action means you have to put your bullet in, push the bolt lever down, fire your shot, lift the bolt lever up, pull it back, put the new bullet in, push it in, fire it down again. A street going in front of that is on an incline. So Oswald had to be sticking himself out that window, turning to the right and aiming at a moving target, and fired three shots. And he did that three shots in 12 seconds. There's no way. He hit his target twice, by the way. No way. There's no way you could have done that. They have a display there where they showed a sharpshooter had come in there and tried to do the same thing several years ago. He couldn't do it. He couldn't hit the moving target twice in that 12 seconds with that same type of a rifle. He just couldn't do it. So you're wondering, well, how the hell did Oswald do this and hit his target twice? Now all of a sudden I'm starting to think maybe there was a second shooter. Well, we look around. We are seeing all kinds of interesting objects and things that were there. I just had to touch that window. And so I'm just sitting there with my hand on that window, just touching it, thinking, man, what happened here in 1963, 57 years ago? So after we left, we went down, we hooked up with Richard and Barbara, and we decided, okay, now we're going to go drive around. So we went downtown and we went to the Texas Theater. Now, this is the theater that Oswald was captured in. It's still operating, kind of run down. They stayed in the car and I just wanted to go up there and just look at it and touch the wall or something. So I go up there and the manager was just walking out and I asked him, I go, hey, can I go in there and take a look? And he goes, you looking for the seat that Oswald was in? I go, yeah, as a matter of fact, that's what I am. He goes, it's not in here. I go, what do you mean it's not in here? He says, no, it was taken out years ago. It's in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. And I go, okay. So he says, so there's really nothing here to see. I go, but this is the Texas Theater. And he goes, yeah, this is it. And again, kind of run down, but okay. So then we get in the car and we drive to the intersection of 10th and Patton. Now, this is where Officer J.D. Tippett was in his patrol car, saw a man matching Oswald's description, got out, was going to talk to Oswald. As he walked around the front of the car, Oswald pulled out his rifle and unloaded his entire gun. Actually, it wasn't a rifle, it was a gun. And unloaded all of it into Officer Tippett. Officer Tippett was dead before he ever hit the ground. There was a gentleman across the street that was watching this, that watched Oswald run down the street reloading his gun. And that's when he jumped on the bus and went to the Texas Theater. So there's a sign outside of this intersection right there, and it tells basically this is what happened on this particular date. So I read the sign there and I thought, okay. Now we're back in the car, and we decide we're going to make the drive to Fort Worth. Fort Worth has a cemetery. It's called the Rose Hill Cemetery. And I found it online, and it's the cemetery where Lee Harvey Oswald's grave is. So we thought, well, you know what? Let's take a ride out there. So we drive out, and I was surprised that Fort Worth was a little bit of a drive to get out there. Punched this all into my GPS, and we're driving out there. We get there, and it's a beautiful cemetery. I mean, it's very well maintained. And we drive in, and there's this elderly man kind of like working on, working on the yards there. And I walked up to him, and I says, hey, where is Lee Harvey Oswald's grave? And he looked at me, and he says, it's not here. And I said, what do you mean it's not here? Yes, it is. He goes, no, it's not here. So I got back in the car, and I fired up my laptop, and I went on the site that I had looked, and sure enough, it's here. And it shows on a picture of it. It shows a mausoleum on the right and this huge oak tree on the left. Three rows over from the oak tree, there's his grave. So we're sitting there, and I'm looking. Well, wait a minute. There's the mausoleum. So to the left, okay, there's the oak tree. So it's got to be a couple of rows over. So we get out. So the four of us, myself, my wife, Captain Richard, and Barbara, are out, and we're walking around, and we're looking. I says, wait a minute. That photograph said two rows over, three sections down. So I walked the two rows over, walked down three sections. There it was. All it said was Oswald. That's all it said. Oswald. Nothing else. No dates, nothing. Just Oswald. And I thought, okay, I am standing in front of Lee Harvey Oswald's grave. And it was really interesting. There was a grave right next to it. And I mean close to it. It said Jack Betts. B-E-T-T-S. Jack Betts. And I thought, I wonder who the hell he is. So as we were leaving, I saw the elderly gentleman again who was doing the yard work. And I go, hey, I thought you said Oswald wasn't here. We found him. And he just kind of looked at me and smiled. And he says, yeah, I figured you would find him. I go, what did you tell me he wasn't here for? He says, because we're told to say that. And I go, really, why? He goes, you got to understand, a lot of people would like to come up and some of them would like to vandalize Oswald's grave. The headstone was already taken once. The headstone originally said Lee Harvey Oswald, and that was stolen. So now all it said was Oswald. And he says, you have to understand that we don't want this to be a tourist attraction. I says, let me ask you a question. I go, who is Jack Betts? The man that was right next to Oswald. He says, Jack Betts is nobody. And I go, come on, what do you mean he's nobody? He was obviously somebody. He goes, no, he's nobody. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, it's an empty grave. And I go, what? He says, they did not want anybody next to Oswald. So they made up a name, Jack Betts, made up a stone and placed it right there next to him so that nobody would be buried next to him. You're kidding. No, there is no Jack Betts buried there. And I thought, well, that is so weird. So I asked him, I said, so why this particular cemetery? This is so far out from Dallas. Why this one? And he goes, you need to understand that back on the day, 1963 in November, when Oswald shot the president, nobody wanted his body. Nobody wanted Oswald's body. They were the only cemetery that would take his body. And that's why he's buried clear out there. And I thought, wow, interesting. So we got back in the car. I remember looking at Barbara and she says, well, you saw it. You saw everything you wanted to see, didn't you? And I go, yeah, I did. It took me several years. I saw everything I wanted to see. It was amazing. It was simply amazing. We went back to our hotel, said our goodnights to Richard and Barbara, and we went into our room. And I just sat at the window, this large, large window, looking out over Dallas. And Patty says, what are you thinking? And I said, you know what? Check this off my bucket list. I came. I saw everything that I wanted to see. I will tell you this. When I leave here, I have more questions than I did when I got here. More questions about what happened. We got up the next morning, and as we left, we drove to the airport, and we happened to drive right past the Texas School Book Depository building. And we drove right over the X's. Not intentionally. It was just the way that we had to go to get to the airport. And I looked at it, and I thought, huh. Crazy enough, we're taken off out of the Love Field, which was the same airport that the president landed and his body was removed from. And I thought to myself, this is a beautiful city. It's a beautiful, beautiful town. The people there were fabulous. The people there were wonderful. Would I come back to this town? Yeah, I'd come back to Dallas again. It was on my bucket list for many, many years. And finally, it's no longer on my bucket list, but I got to see it. But I'll tell you this, I left Dallas with a lot more questions than I did when I arrived. Do I think there was a second shooter? I do now. I don't think Lee Harvey Oswald, by looking at the angle and everything we looked at, I don't think he could have pulled it off by himself. Time will only tell. Maybe or maybe not. We'll just have to see. We are just about out of time for today's show. Remember, you can catch our show every Saturday at 10 a.m. and a replay Sundays at 11 a.m. here on Salem's original radio station, KSLM. A reminder, if you missed any of today's show or would like to hear any of my shows, you can always hear a podcast on our official KSLM website at www.kslm.news or on my official website at www.terrysaul.com. If you would like to drop me a note, I would love to hear from you. My email address is terry@kslm.news. We'll see you next time. Take care and be safe.
You've been listening to The Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM and 1220 AM KSLM. Today's show is brought to you by the Willamette Queen Sternwheeler. The next time you plan an event, think of the Queen. And by the Lule Group, featuring Lule's Car Connection, Don Lule Holmes, and Teresa Lule's State Farm Insurance. That's a wrap. Thanks, everybody. Good show.
Bye, everybody.